The case of Nunn versus Mid-Century Insurance. I want to advise the parties that Justice Hobbs is not able to be here with us this afternoon, but he does intend to participate in the case. So we're ready to hear from the petitioner, please.
May it please the court, my name is Thomas Neville, attorney registration number 35011. I'm here with Brad Levine, my co-counsel, and we'll be splitting our time for this argument, and we represent the appellant, Nicole Nunn. We're going to talk briefly about the facts of this case, in particular the bad faith facts, and I will be addressing Ross briefly and the policies that underlie it, and then we'll talk some about Hamilton. Mr. Levine is going to talk more broadly about the judgment rule and the broader policy implications of this case. The issue that is in front of this court today is when and how an insured may protect himself or herself from an insurer's bad faith conduct. Now, in this case, the insurer, Mid-Century, determined within 3 days of the accident that their insured was 100% at fault for the accident, that the victim, Ms. Nunn, was the most severely injured of the claimants, and they even reserved her claim at $100,000. They also decided at that time to send the matter out for interpleader. This is a significant decision because, as they acknowledged in deposition, an interpleader is a last resort because an interpleader does nothing to protect its insured and does nothing to obtain a release of liability for its insured. Now, in December of that year, Gillis Powell, Ms. Nunn's attorney, contacted Mid-Century and made a policy limits demand on Mid-Century. And that demand was rejected.
Sorry, Mr. Neville. As I read Mr. Lebsack's brief, he indicates there's evidence contrary to that.
Well, Your Honor, this case was decided on summary judgment.
Yes.
And, well, I suppose it's true that there is some allegation that the claims filed doesn't reflect that the demand was made. Mr. Powell's testimony was that he made the demand. His affidavit shows that he made the demand. And shortly after he made the demand, Mid-Century contacted Varnell and Associates to determine what the status of the interpleader that they had requested 6 months prior to that. That suggests at the very least.
Going too fast for me.
I'm sorry. That suggests.
Was there a written letter?
There was
no. This is a verbal.
There's a verbal demand made on the phone.
To an adjuster?
Yes.
And how long after the accident was it?
It was about 5 months after the accident. So, despite the demand for policy limits, Mid-Century did nothing to negotiate with Ms. Nunn after that demand was made. It made no efforts to negotiate with the other claimants beyond the filing of the interpleader. Now, ultimately, Ms. Nunn filed a liability suit in the Federal District Court. There were two settlement conferences held in that court to which Mid-Century was invited and at which it appeared and participated. And those settlement conferences were supervised by a federal magistrate. And at the end of the day, Mid-Century unconditionally assented to the entry of the Basher agreement that gives rise to this case. In Old Republic v. Ross, this court announced a rule. And the rule that it announced was that in cases where an insurer had not been involved in a case where there was no breach of the duty to defend, no breach of the duty to, no denial of coverage, and no bad faith conduct, a Basher agreement entered into pretrial would be unenforceable. And in reaching this, this court considered a number of opinions from around the country, and in part relied on the policy that was described by the Alaska Supreme Court in Carpenter. And what it said there was that a covenant not to execute ordinarily means that the insured has not suffered personal loss. But covenant settlement agreements are given effect because it is thought that an insured that has been placed at economic risk by its insurer's breach should be allowed to protect himself by shifting the risk to the breaching insurer without first subjecting itself to potential financial ruin. That is exactly the situation that Mr. James found himself in here. Because Mid-Century, through its conduct, cost him the opportunity to settle his case within policy limits and cost him the opportunity to obtain a full release of liability. And as a result, he was exposed to a judgment well in excess of his assets and well in excess of the policy limits. There is no question that MidCentury acknowledges that the value of this claim is between $2 and $5 million, and the Basher agreement that was entered into resulted in a judgment of $4 million being entered against Mr. James.
So he had exposure and protected himself and suffered a judgment which will not be executed. Specifically though, what are his damages?
Well, the damage is the entry of the judgment against him. This the state has recognized the judgment rule for at least 30 years, and as in Basher, where there was a covenant not to execute, an insured obtains that protection such that they don't have to pay the judgment, but that doesn't mean that they haven't suffered the damage.
If you are successful here and this case goes to trial, what would be the damages that for which you would seek recovery from the jury?
The $4 million judgment that was entered against Mr. James.
And that $4 million judgment at trial would then be what kind of evidence as to the extent of damages?
Well, Your Honor,
conclusive or?
Your Honor, there would be evidence of the extent of Ms. Nunn's injuries. She's paralyzed from the waist down. There would be evidence that in its own claims handling, MidCentury evaluated this case as being between $2 and $5 million. There would be a life care plan that would describe what injuries she suffered and what the likely costs of dealing with those over her lifetime would be.
I'm sorry, but I'm a little confused about how that relates to the damages for the bad faith claim, which is what you would be pursuing, correct?
Well, correct. Courts around the country have said that a pretrial agreement such as this can be enforceable, provided that it's reasonable. So our burden would be to show the reasonableness of the damages and the liability aspect of this case. But I think that in a case like this, where the injuries are extreme, the insurance company has acknowledged that the damages are reasonably within the range that could be expected. That goes a long way to proving what needs to be proved as far as damages are concerned. Now, in the Court of Appeals, MidCentury relied heavily on the case of Hamilton versus Maryland Casualty Company. And Hamilton comes from the California Supreme Court. And Hamilton itself is inconsistent with the Court of Appeals' opinion in this case. In Hamilton, the California Supreme Court said that in situations where there has been bad faith, an insured may enter into a pretrial Basher agreement coupled with a covenant not to execute and an assignment of rights prior to trial. But Hamilton dealt with the policy issue of how do we determine what damages are reasonable. And Hamilton's indication that that was an acceptable set of steps to take is inconsistent with the Court of Appeals holding that where there's a pretrial covenant not to execute, there are no damages. The other thing that Hamilton says is, under the facts of that case, where the insurer is not involved in the process of crafting the pretrial Basher agreement and in the process of resolving the underlying liability, then the judgment carries no weight. But again, this case is a different situation. Here, the insurer was involved at every step of the way. They were informed as to what was going on, and they were given the opportunity to object. And as Mr. Mabee's letter, which is contained in the record, indicates, had they objected to the pretrial Basher agreement, the case would have gone to trial. They would have tried the liability case, and they would have sought damages. But instead, MidCentury gave their unqualified assent to the agreement that was entered here.
What did that mean exactly? They gave their assent. What position were they in? They're not a party to the agreement. You mean, well, they knew about it and didn't object for their insured?
They knew about it. They raised objections to it, to the language as it was phrased. And plaintiff's counsel below said, those objections are unacceptable. We don't agree to go forward with this on the terms that you have presented. You have to agree to the agreement that we've drafted, or we'll try the liability case. So they had control over whether this agreement was executed.
Well, what happened then?
What happened then? They, as I said, they gave their qualified assent. Plaintiff's counsel objected to that, and they followed up with a letter saying that they gave their unqualified assent to the entry of the judgment. The entry of judgment was entered, and a bad faith case was started by Ms. Nunn, which is where we were at the trial court when the summary judgment was entered against us.
And what do you need that faith case? What are the major issues that you will have to prove in the bad faith? You don't have to prove the amount of damages in the underlying accident, I assume.
Correct.
Okay, so you just have to prove that the insurer acted in bad faith?
And that they acted unreasonably, and that unreasonable conduct gave rise to the set of circumstances where Mr. James was forced to defend himself by entering into the Basher agreement.
And you said earlier that the facts that you were reciting about the plaintiff's counsel having made an offer to settle for the policy limits, should we accept those facts as true for purposes of this case? I wasn't quite sure what your position was.
I think given the procedural posture of the case at this time, because it was decided on summary judgment, that any genuine issues of material fact need to be drawn in our favor, and any inferences that can be drawn from the evidence also should be drawn in our favor. Ultimately, if we fail to prove that an offer was made or that bad faith occurred, there will be no recovery in this case. And at that, I would like to pass off the remainder of my time to Mr. Levine.
May it please the court. The upshot of this case is that the Court of Appeals decision is contrary to what this court decided just 2 years ago in the Ross case.
Excuse me, could you just identify yourself for the record?
Oh, I apologize, Your Honor. I'm Bradley Levine.
Thank you.
The decision cannot be squared with the Ross case. It cannot be squared with the Basher case that was decided 40 years ago by this court. And the reason is that what the Court of Appeals said is that because of the fact that there was this covenant not to execute, that essentially excused or eliminated any kinds of damages, and therefore there was nothing to be recovered against the insurance company. That proposition is contrary to the whole notion of being able to enter into these types of agreements that this court said was valid when it decided the Ross case, and like I say, all the way back to the Basher case, because in the Basher case itself, which was the seminal case that was decided in 1972 by this court, we had a covenant not to execute. That is what is the cornerstone for any one of these types of agreements. In other words, the way that the insured is protected is, and what they're doing is they're purchasing the protection, as Mr. Neville was talking about, because the insurance company didn't act in conformance with their obligations under the insurance policy. So what you have to do under those circumstances is get some type of an agreement with the claimant, with the injured party. And as part and parcel of that, there's going to be a judgment that's going to be entered. And as part and parcel of that agreement, you need to have this covenant not to execute on that judgment. That's the protection that you're receiving. And all the cases that this court relied on in reaching its decision in the Ross case have said that this is an important integral aspect, and it is something which it doesn't wipe out the damages. It's something that a bad faith breaching insurance company cannot complain about. They're not in a position to be able to say, well, even though we have not acted appropriately, and Chief Justice Malarkey, in terms of your question here, we have, because this case was decided in summary judgment, Ms. Nunn has not had the opportunity to establish her bad faith claim. So for purposes of the case at this juncture, we have to assume that we have got facts to go forward to the jury with to establish bad faith conduct. If the insurance company did in fact act in bad faith, they don't have the ability to go back and say, well, there weren't any damages because of the fact that there's this covenant not to execute. And that gets to another aspect of the Court of Appeals opinion. The Court of Appeals says, well, even though there's this covenant not to execute, there's really no difference between a covenant not to execute and a release. And again, the courts uniformly have said, no, that's not true, that a release extinguishes the liability in toto. If we're talking about a covenant not to execute, that is simply a promise that says, as long as you comply with the conditions of this agreement that we've reached, that we're not going to be executing on that judgment. But it doesn't eviscerate the judgment itself. And it is a mechanism by which these types of agreements that this court said was appropriate under appropriate circumstances, and all that this court did, this court in Roth said it was adopting a rule that has been universally recognized, and it talked about, as Mr. Neville talked about, the case from the Carpenter case from Alaska, the Bessel case from Washington, the whole host of other cases that have said that this is appropriate. And I would note that what it seems to us that Mid-Century must not feel very strongly about its position, to the extent to which before this court, what they've done is that they have started their briefing out not by trying to support the rationale from the Court of Appeals, but to change gears on us. What they've asked this court now to do is to adopt the Hamilton rule out of California, a posture that was never argued by Mid-Century at any point along the line before it got before this court. And as we've noted in our brief, there's a problem there because we believe that the record has not been sufficiently established in order to for this court to evaluate that. In particular, what they're saying is that if the that the rule that they want is that if the insurance company is defending unequivocally without any reservation of rights, that they should, that a party should not be allowed to enter into one of these pre-judgment types of agreements. But instead, even if the insurance company has wrongfully refused to settle, that they should be able to force the insured to go all the way through trial before entering into one of these agreements. The difficulty is that the evidence before that's in the record is that there was a reservation of rights letter that was sent out. We've got representations by counsel as to what the contents of that letter are, but that letter is not part of the record in this case.
Mr. Levine, if I could interrupt you, isn't that the tension, though, that we've been dealing with as a court for the last 2 or 3 years in the Ross case and now again here, which is that tension between a probable or at least a concern about collusion between the parties as against the insurance company, and yet at the other hand some way to protect the defendant? And in Ross we weren't willing to go quite the whole route and say, well, pre-case stipulations are all right, and we only were willing to go so far as to say, well, they're okay if there is evidence of bad faith, because you've put a defendant into an untenable position. You know all this, so that's just preface to my question. So where really are we going now? I mean, what do you think the new holding should be? Or how do you think this case should be decided, I guess, given this background?
I think, Your Honor, I think the way this case should be decided is that what this court pronounced in Ross should be sustained in this case.
So there should be no difference. We should continue to recognize those tensions and just say, absent, what? You fill in the blank.
Yes, absent, there are two prongs to it.
Please.
One, as Mr. Neville said, you have to establish that it was reasonable. And what courts have said, if you look at, for example, the Metcalf case out of Nebraska, what they talk about is whether or not the amount that was agreed to is within a reasonable range, okay? And what I would suggest, at least in this case, is that there's no question about that because Mid-Century agreed to the terms of the settlement.
So that would happen at the trial level in the new lawsuit,
yes,
contesting the reasonableness of the pre-trial stipulation.
Yes, so that's one prong.
Okay.
The second prong is whether or not there was fraud or collusion with respect to the entry of the agreement. And what I would suggest is that this court, in the Stubbs versus Copper Mountain case, has set forth the standard for what constitutes collusion. And when we're talking about collusion, it's where the conduct is being undertaken by the parties in order to essentially injure, in order to prejudice the rights of the non-party to that agreement. That would be what the standard is. And of course, that's not the case here, because what I would suggest that in virtually all these circumstances that the reason that you've entered into this agreement is because the insured has not received the protection that they are entitled to under the liability policy, and therefore they are entering into the agreement in order to protect themselves because the insurance company wasn't protecting them. But that's the two-pronged approach which other courts have taken, and I think is appropriate in this case.
Which is consistent with Ross. How would we determine whether or not there has been bad faith at that stage? In this instance, you're saying, well, there's bad faith because all they did was file an interpleader and nothing much else, right?
There's more to it than that, Your Honor. Okay. It has to do with the fact that, as Mr. Neville was talking about, they had opportunities. They knew right away, they knew within 48 hours that Ms. Nunn was severely injured. She was the most severely injured of all the passengers in that vehicle. They knew that liability was clear, in fact, was aggravated because of the drinking and driving that was involved. So they readily should have realized that she was entitled to certainly the $100,000 policy limit. At that juncture, I would suggest, even without any kind of demand for that policy limit, that the insurance company had an obligation to offer up the $100,000 to Ms. Nunn. But certainly, in the face of the demands that were being made, and again, there may be contested issues of fact, that's to be decided by the trial court, but that in face of the demands that were being made for those policy limits and the insurance company's refusal to offer them up, including on the basis that because Ms. Nunn was represented by a Florida lawyer that they weren't going to communicate with him, and the failure by the company, because this is one of the other obligations that the courts in the state have recognized, that insurance company has an obligation when they receive those kinds of demands to communicate those to the insured. And there's no evidence whatsoever that MidCentury communicated those to their insured. So all I'm suggesting, Justice Rice, is that there are a whole host of facts which we believe constitute bad faith conduct by the insurance carrier. There never should have been litigation filed in the first place. And this insurance company had an obligation right from the get-go to sort this out and get these policy proceeds to Ms. Nunn as quickly as possible under these circumstances. The failure to do that constitutes bad faith under all the case law that's been established by this court, under the standards that set forth in CR Section 10.3.1104 that sets forth the standard for establishing bad faith conduct. I would also suggest, and the problem in terms of this whole idea about using the Hamilton approach, and again, Mr. Neville alluded to this, but the problem in terms of Hamilton is not only is it inconsistent with Ross, but that the facts that we have certainly in this case are disparate in the fact that, A, as I say, the insurance company was involved, that they knew about the terms of this settlement. The other thing, though, is that if you look at, again, those facts as I just delineated them, we're not talking here about an instance where, you know, the insurance company has stepped in and they're defending, and during the course of the defense that there's been a policy limits demand and a failure to pay the policy limits amount and so on. Once again, under the facts in this case, you've got an instance where there never should have been litigation in the first place. It was the bad faith conduct by the insurance company that led to the filing of the lawsuit, and it never should have happened. So the upshot of it is that these are matters to be decided on a case-by-case basis. It's something which Ms. Nunn is entitled to present to the trial court, to have her day in court to establish bad faith conduct under the circumstances in this case. And yes, as part and parcel of her burden of proof, it will be to establish that this $4 million amount is reasonable, and it will be her, and by the way, then it should be a shifted obligation of the insurance company to establish that the sole basis for this agreement is based upon some type of fraud or collusive conduct, as opposed to, as I say, trying to do a benefit, to create a benefit that the insurance company deprived Mr. James of by its bad faith conduct.
So then let me just ask you a couple questions about the agreement itself, which I have in front of me, I think. And basically what it suggests is nothing, at least just from looking at it, is nothing more than the fact that Mr. James was in fact being represented by somebody from Farmers. But that, if I'm reading it correctly, he felt that the damages were going to be greater than his policy limits. He felt that he had been deprived of the opportunity to put the matters at issue behind him because the claim had gone on for too long and he was concerned about exposure. And that's it. Paragraphs 5, 6, 7, 8, I think it is in your recitals. I mean, wouldn't that be true of many, many people who find themselves in this position, or almost anybody who would be concerned about the outcome of a lawsuit?
Well, it's not just anybody who's putting that outcome. I would suggest, Your Honor, that you have, hopefully, insurance companies in the state are acting appropriately and consistent with their duties, and that they aren't put in a position such as this where they're facing a huge liability to someone as badly injured as Ms. Nunn, and it's because the insurance company didn't act appropriately that they're in that position. Be that as it may, again, you might want to enter into one of these agreements and do it on a spurious basis, but you then have the burden of proving the bad faith. In other words, the insurance company, and that's one of the things this court said in the Ross case, is that MidCentury is still entitled to all their defenses. They're still going to be able to say that, hey, you know, we acted appropriately, here's what happened, you know, and have people come up and we file this interpleader action. If they think that that's a defense, they're still going to have that opportunity. I wanted to point out one other thing in terms of, again, getting to this whole notion about the Hamilton case and its inapplicability here, and that has to do with what Mr. Neville alluded to, and it's the difference between what's called the judgment rule and the payment rule, and that's the real one that cuts the problems with the Court of Appeals opinion here, is that, and this gets to what you're asking about, Justice Martinez, is that that judgment amount, that is the damage. Because what this court held, and it goes all the way back to the Trimble case, what this court has found is that it is the judgment itself, because under the terms of the insurance policy says that the insurance company is saying that they are going to pay the amounts that the insured is legally obligated to pay. And so that judgment becomes a legal obligation. We don't adopt, and the courts across the country have eschewed this whole payment rule. It's not a question of whether or not you have the ability to pay, that even a pauper is entitled to have their day and to the protections under the insurance policy.
So, counsel, in your view, MidCentury then would not be able to argue that their course of conduct, including permitting being aware of the stipulation and allowing their insured to stipulate, actually protected their insured, and that they, I think that's part of their argument in the briefs, that they protected their insured from any actual payment of further damages.
Well, sure, they might be able to make that argument, but I would suggest, for all the reasons that we've said, they're the people who put the insured in harm's way because of their conduct. They could try to make whatever those arguments may be, but all I'm suggesting here is that for example, even under the insurance policy itself, there's a bankruptcy provision, and it says that even if the insured is bankrupt, the insurance company has an obligation to act pursuant to the terms of the policy and to resolve the claim. And so what it means is that if you're bankrupt, if you're poor, no matter what, it's not a question of the ability to pay. What we have and what we've adopted in the state is the judgment rule. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time if I could, please.
May it please the court, I'm John Lebsack, and I represent MidCentury Insurance Company. Our argument for affirming the Court of Appeals has two alternatives, and what I'd first like to do is just summarize what those alternatives are, and then I'll discuss those in more detail. The first alternative is that this court should affirm the Court of Appeals on the very same grounds that the Court of Appeals used in reaching its decision, which is that there were no actual damages suffered by Mr. James. Bad faith is a tort. Traditional tort rules apply. He has not faced any real exposure under the judgment. Therefore, he had no actual damages to assign.
Counsel, can I get you to address that? So can you address specifically the petitioner's argument that that would apply to every single Basher agreement that we've considered? Sure. I mean, essentially, I mean, I hear their argument is this is just obliterating the Basher agreement. Or this line of cases. We just won't be able to do them anymore.
It will not. The holding that we urge the court to adopt would not modify Basher in one iota. Post-trial, after the jury makes a finding of what the actual damages are, the covenant not to execute can still be entered, and it can still protect the insured. That is exactly what happened in Hamilton. However, what Hamilton did was say, it's a two-part holding. And we have, from the very start of this case, since the very first summary judgment brief, been saying, please apply Hamilton. And Hamilton has a two-part holding. The first part is that if there is a stipulated judgment entered at a time when the insurance company is defending, that does not presumptively create any damages. There's nothing binding about that judgment on the insurance company. And then they, at the end of the opinion, they say, and because of that, there is no bad faith claim that can be preserved because there are no actual damages. But what the Hamilton case talks about as the way that the insured can still protect himself or herself is a covenant. Now, after trial, Hamilton says that you can do this. Before trial, they say you cannot. Now, the reason that the holding that we're asking the court to make in this case, the ruling, would not affect Bashor is that Bashor had actual damages. In that case, the judgment was for $18,000. The coverage was for $10,000. After the full trial, the insurance company paid the $10,000, and then the plaintiff started to execute. And when the plaintiff started to execute, they worked out what everybody now calls a Bashor agreement, which is that, okay, we'll sue the bad faith, we'll sue the insurance company for bad faith. You pay us $1,500, and then we'll go after the insurance company for the whole $8,000. And what was significant about damages in that case was that the insured had to part with $1,500. And one of the issues in that case was, well, is that really the extent of damages or not? And the court held that because the reimbursement of that would not occur in full unless the complete $8,000 was recovered, for that reason, the claim in that case could be for the full $8,000. So we believe that what the Court of Appeals did and the ruling that we're asking this court to make is consistent with Bashor. The main difference is after trial, after a full verdict and a full judgment actually entered against the defendant rather than a stipulated judgment that's just reached by agreement of the parties. So the first issue that we ask this court to rule on is to affirm the Court of Appeals for the same reasons. The second issue that we ask the court as an alternative, if you decline to accept our damages argument, is to refine the Old Republic holding. And that is that Old Republic talked about the whole universe of situations where you can have a pretrial stipulated judgment. And in that case, the analysis was under any of these scenarios, there is no way that this could be a valid judgment. It cannot be binding under whatever rule you want to apply. Well, we're now in a different situation. We are in the situation where one of those scenarios that the court talked about in Old Republic is involved in this case, and that is an insurance company that's defending and has conceded coverage. It is not necessary to go beyond that. And we believe that under Hamilton, which is front and center in the Old Republic opinion, that that case stands for the proposition that if the carrier's defending and there's a stipulated judgment at that time, that that's not binding on the insurance company. So let me back up from those legal issues and just review some of the facts briefly, because there are very much disputed facts, but not on the issues that the court granted summary judgment on and not on the issues that we're urging this court to adopt.
Are there disputed facts, though, on the basis for the recital for the Bashor agreement?
The Bashor speaks for itself.
Well, I was asking Mr. Levine about it, and it seems to be pretty bare bones.
Well, you know, the record doesn't show where those recitals came from. The record shows that here's the agreement. It was worked out by Mr. James' lawyer and by Ms. Nunn's attorney. Farmers knew about it, obviously, because we sent a letter saying we're granting Mr. James permission to enter into this. But as far as the recitals, as far as whether or not those facts are true, they're disputed. He recites in there that, you know, he was exposed to this because of Farmer's improper conduct. That's very much a disputed issue. So those recitals you know, obviously we disagree with. So, but those, that claim handling, whether or not that was proper, whether there were mistakes that were made, whether it was in good faith or bad faith, that's all disputed. What is not disputed is the Bashore Agreement and what it says and the consequences that flow from that Bashore Agreement. It's a document. It speaks for itself. But let me just back up and go through a few of the key events in the claim handling, because there's only one incident in this where there's really any dispute as to what happened. First of all, as my colleagues have already gone over, right from the start, Mid-Century recognized that there was not enough insurance coverage to go around. There were five terribly injured teenagers and an insurance policy with $100,000, $300,000 limit. So within a matter of days, they decided that the full amount was available to settle the claims. They decided to use the mechanism of an interpleader. And the record on why they did that, the record is not complete on that. The reason for that is that the record that we put together was a summary judgment record. We submitted the briefs, we submitted the deposition testimony that relate to the issue for summary judgment, which was, you know, was there actual damages? Because there is a black and white dispute as to the nature of a phone call, no summary judgment was possible as to that phone call and everything that flows from the phone call. The phone call between the adjuster and Ms. Nunn's attorney in Florida is where supposedly the limits demand was made. And one person to the phone call says, I made a limits demand. The other person, the adjuster, says, never happened. And there's nothing in the claim file that says that an offer was made. So we have a very plain fact dispute on what the nature of that phone call was.
So for purposes of this case, do we assume that the plaintiff's version of the facts are correct?
No, I believe what you can say is that the plaintiffs allege that in this phone call a limits demand was made. Defendants dispute that. I don't think that that is a material fact for purposes of upholding the Court of Appeals judgment. I don't think it's fair, based on this record, which does not have the deposition testimony of the adjuster, where she says it never happened. I don't think it's fair to assume that the plaintiff's version is correct. There's only one side of the conversation that is in the record. That's because of the nature of the summary judgment motion that was filed. So the adjuster is Michelle Sol. Yes.
Is it uncontested that farmers assigned the limit or a range between $2 and $5 million early on?
It is correct. That is in a letter. It's not exactly early on, but at the point where the case went into suit, when Mr. James was when Ms. Nunn actually filed a lawsuit against Mr. James in federal court, at that point, I believe this was August of 2001, there is a comprehensive retrospective report that one of the farmers' counsel made summarizing what had happened to date. And in that letter, he said, you know, they claim that there was a limits demand made. We don't see that a limits demand was made. And we believe that the fair value of this case is $2 million to $5 million. So yes, that is a fact that is in the letter that the Farmers Council, in-house counsel, wrote.
Is there any evidence whatsoever that farmers offered policy limits on their own? I mean, aside from the contested telephone call?
Offer is the key word that I want to explain. Making available the full $300,000 limit to all of the five people, that happened. As far as contacting any of the individual people to say, we are offering you this, that didn't happen. So as far as an offer of $100,000, that did not happen until the settlement conference where the other claims were resolved. So the facts were that after Farmers Mid-Century filed the interpleader and deposited the $300,000, there was a settlement conference. Everybody was invited. Four of the claimants attended, One did not, and that was Ms. Nunn. The other four reached an agreement to divide up $200,000. And those cases were settled with releases. And farmers, that money was paid out of the registry of the court. And there was $100,000 left in the registry of the court that was available for Ms. Nunn. At that time, that's when the lawsuit was filed in federal court. So at that time, there was $100,000 available to her, but as far as before the rest of the claims were resolved, there was never a specific indication from farmers that you can have the 100. That was the problem in why they decided to go with the interpleader, was what do we do about these other four people who may have access claims themselves?
From what you said, the insurance company knew that their insured was likely liable for a great deal more than the policy limits.
They recognized that from the very first day that they got the claim.
And what did they do with that, with respect to the insured, or do we not know anything?
You don't know the full story, but in a nutshell, what they decided to do was an interpleader as a mechanism. Now, the petitioner disputes that that is an appropriate way to do it. The claim handlers in their depositions explained why they believed that it was the right way that they wanted to do it. It's, you know, in hindsight, you can second guess whether it was the right decision or not, but that's what they decided to do, was an interpleader. And they recognized that we can't force people to give a release, but the theory was that if we get people together, that's how we can get this whole thing resolved, by getting people together. That was the goal of the interpleader.
Slepsack, maybe you could address this. I'm having a little trouble. It seems to me that the best argument against pre-judgment settlement is that it doesn't represent an arm's length transaction, and it's some sort of collusion against an insurance company. And that's the policy reason, right? Generally.
That's one good reason. There's another one which has to do with duty of defense, but I'll get to that.
Right, all right. That's true, too. But what is there about this case on a factual basis that indicates any form of, I don't know, collusion, fraud, unfairness in terms of the judgment amount and the liability of the insured in this case?
Well, you know, I have to admit that the amount of $4 million is between what the Farmers Council said was the fair value.
Well, that seems like that's a reasonable figure.
It's not a
maybe a little bit on the high side, but certainly within limits of what your own people say.
Right. But here's what I'm going to suggest is the better way to do it, which is the Hamilton way of doing it as opposed to the other way of doing it. There are two problems with these stipulated judgments. One is they are numbers, and I don't want to say picked out of the air. They're not exactly picked out of the air, but they are not the result of disputed litigation before a neutral fact finder. So there is no question about it that these are estimates that are no substitute for a jury verdict in a personal injury case. So these also are entered at a time when the insurance company is exercising its right to control the defense. So I want to put this scenario, the time scene, in the context of what this court has said is the responsibility of the insurance company when you're defending. Now, there's three landmark cases that define what the duty of defense is, and this is a very liberal duty to be interpreted in the favor of the insured. The Hecla case, the Cypress case, both of these say that if there's any doubt about it, defend. So the rule in Colorado is be very liberal in defending. Long ago, 20 years ago, in the Trimble case, the court also recognized that the insurance company has, quote, the absolute right to control the defensive actions brought against the insured. And the insured is therefore precluded from interfering with the investigation or negotiation for settlement. Hamilton involved a situation where the stipulated judgment took place while the carrier was defending. And that's the key thing that I keep coming back to. We're asking the court to narrow what Old Republic versus Ross said. Old Republic, as you know, did not involve an effort to collect the judgment. It was an effort where it was interest on top of a judgment, and the question was, is that judgment, does it mean anything? The interest was due under the contract. So there was no question of, you know, extra contractual responsibility for the judgment. It was, is there anything in the contract that would require them to pay that? So in looking at whether there was any circumstance where that judgment could be binding as to the insurance company, the court addressed all the different situations where pretrial stipulated judgments have been binding. And there's a passage in Old Republic on page 431 where, actually, excuse me, 432. And the court, first of all, said that this is an issue of first impression. The validity of pretrial assignments is an issue of first impression. And toward the end of page 432, the court talked about the majority rule of courts which have considered this issue. And the court wrote that stipulated pretrial judgments may be enforceable against the liability insurer if the insurer breaches its contractual obligation to defend. The rest of that paragraph elaborates on all the cases that have recognized that. The next paragraph goes on to discuss every other type of situation where a stipulated pretrial judgment has been enforced. And the reason that it was needed in that case, unlike this case, was that could there be any scenario where this judgment that had been stipulated judgment that had been entered in Old Republic, could that ever be valid? And the court went through all the different scenarios and none of them applied. So therefore, the net effect of this is that regardless of how you look at it, this judgment could never be valid. We're dealing with a different situation, and we're dealing with only that first scenario that the court talked about, which was the majority rule as seen in Hamilton. And what we want the court, what I ask the court to consider, is applying that paragraph as the rule in this case, which is that if the stipulated judgment is entered while the carrier is defending, it's not binding as against the insurance company. The other cases that are cited in the next paragraph, I recognize that some of those cases would support what the petitioners are trying to do. In particular, the Bessel case out of Washington. I don't know whether it's Bessel or Beisel, but I want to read you two quotes from Hamilton and from Bessel. And the Hamilton quote is, you know, from that majority rule from the first paragraph in Old Republic, and then Bessel is cited in the next paragraph. And I'm going to submit to the court that it's needed in this case to decide which one of these rules is going to be the law in Colorado. First, I'll read from Bessel. We hold that the amount of a covenant judgment is the presumptive measure of an insured's harm caused by an insurer's tortious bad faith, if the judgment is reasonable. Now, here's what Hamilton said. Is the amount of a stipulated judgment presumptively binding on the insured as to damages suffered by the insured as a result of the alleged breach of contract? We conclude that it is not. Now, the Bessel quote is 49 Pacific 3rd at 891, and the Hamilton quote is at 41 P 3rd 130. Absolute incompatible rules. The Bessel case says that a stipulated pretrial judgment, even if the carrier is defending, is presumptively binding. Hamilton says just the opposite. There's reasoning behind Hamilton that the court goes into, the California Supreme Court goes into, that is not present in the Bessel case, and we think that
Slapsack, can
yes.
I tell you what's bothering me? It seemed like we discussed a lot of the policy decisions in Ross, and we came about, and basically the opinion said, pretty much, it's very tough and very unusual circumstances to get the presumptive judgment without a trial. I mean, but we didn't close the door. And so it seems to me that what I don't understand is, at least at this juncture, the summary judgment motion, why that hasn't been met here, at least in terms of that.
Well, let me
because it seems to me you've got a situation where you admitted there's enormous, there's no question about liability, there's no question about damages to the injured party. So the only issue is bad faith. And at least on paper, they have an argument for bad faith in terms of summary judgment. Now maybe there's no basis for it, who knows, once there's a trial. But I don't understand why it doesn't fit the exception that we specifically talked about in Ross. Yeah. And that's where my problem is. I mean, if you're really concerned about collusion, you're really concerned about fraud, this doesn't seem to be that kind of case. You are seriously concerned about whether or not there's bad faith. Okay, there's a factual dispute.
Right. Well, you know, I concede the point that this is not a case where fraud and collusion is the number one reason. But what I am stressing is that there were two different scenarios in Ross, Old Republic, where the stipulated pretrial judgments can be effective. And the court discussed both of them. One is where the carrier's defending, and you can't do it then. The other is, even if the carrier's defending, if there's an allegation of bad faith, you can do it. And so we're asking the court to not use the second one, where if the carrier's defending, just an allegation of bad faith is enough to permit this.
So they at least have some evidence of bad faith, maybe not enough to carry the day. I mean, I don't
they have an affidavit, a deposition. Well, you know, it's easy to claim bad faith. You know, it's easy to come up with something that you can say that was not the reasonable way to handle it. So we think that between balancing the two approaches, it's too easy to just allege there was bad faith and therefore permit this, which is what the Washington Supreme Court said in Bessel, versus the Hamilton case in California, where they said we need to restrict this. If the carrier's defending, it's not presumptively binding. Now, the Hamilton court went on to explain why that's a problem, because they pointed out some issues of prejudice, that if you take the damages aspect of the personal injury case, which is going to have to be resolved by a jury at some point. It's either going to be resolved in the personal injury case or it's going to be resolved in the bad faith case. What Hamilton recognized was that if you do it in the personal injury case, that's a mechanism that is designed for that purpose. You get an absolute, I don't want to call pinpoint, but you're getting a specific jury verdict in a forum that is designed for that specific purpose. In contrast to a bad faith case, where the same jury that is going to hear coverage issues, the insurance company's involved, and they're also going to have to find what the reasonable amount of damages were in an indirect way. It is not going to be a question to the jury, what are the total amount of damages sustained based on the evidence you've heard? It's going to be, is this amount reasonable? Is this amount that was agreed to, is this within the ballpark? And there's going to be, instead of just direct testimony, there's going to be experts to come in. You know, you'd never have in a personal injury case an expert come in and say, well, I think the value of this case is, you know, $500,000. In a bad faith case, you would have exactly that. So the procedure that the Hamilton court...
So that's like, yes. I understand the distinction in terms of where those damages would be proved up. But you seem to be saying that implicitly, the manner of doing it, and if the liability were directly at issue, is better, fairer. And I wonder if you could just explain that. In other words, I'm not sure that I so immediately go to the point that I think you're making, which is if you're just trying the reasonableness of this, then somehow that's not a good resolution of the issue.
I just look back at the two ways that you would do this, which is in this case, you know, if the case would have proceeded to verdict, you would have had, you know, the evidence and what the damages were, the economic losses, and you'd have a jury without knowing anything about insurance or, you know, under all the evidentiary rules on how to put a value on a personal injury case, would come up with a number. And that'd be a, you know, neutral fact finder without, you know, evidence of the insurance, without evidence of coverage issues. And then the alternative is, you've got a lawsuit where the insurance company is being, you know, accused of all this horrendous bad faith and ignoring all these responsibilities. And, you know, it's an insurance company involved in the case, which, you know, we've, the rule in Colorado is that insurance in a personal injury case is not relevant. But in, if you call it in the bad faith case, it would be square out there. If there's any coverage issues, for example, if the insurance company has some issues regarding coverage that might play into its position, then those would be resolved at the same time that the amount of damages would be resolved. So, you know, is it possible that a trial of a bad faith case could be handled and determine the amount, the fair value of the damages or of the injury? Yes, but as far as what's more likely and what is kind of a tried and true way to determine that amount, it's the personal injury case.
Well, conceding for, I mean, if I concede for a moment that that's true, I guess you have to sort of balance that difference against the consequences of what you're talking about, because what you're saying is that, if I can reword this a little bit, is that in light of that, the risks and dangers of determining damages in this manner, we shouldn't permit it at all. And the insured, should not be able to protect themselves against the possible claims and should not be able to enter into this type of settlement.
Your Honor, that's not our position. And I keep going back to Hamilton, because we think that that case sets out exactly how it should be done. Hamilton says you can do all this after trial. Covenants are okay after trial, just as I pointed that.
I understand the after trial distinction and the defending distinction.
Right. So if the insured, you know, wants to enter into some protection against, you know, what the insured believes was some improper claim handling, all that can be done. But just don't have a judgment become binding as to the insurance company before the trial. Let the trial happen, let the amount be determined by the fact finder, and then the covenants can happen. That's just like Bashor. So we're just, you know, saying that, you know, if the carrier's defending and exercising, you know, all the responsibilities that come with that, and with the exclusive right to control the defense, then during that stage, these stipulated judgments should not be permitted. Now, Hamilton even talks about a prospective covenant, which can be done not to a specific judgment that's entered at that time, but an agreement before trial that whatever happens after trial, you know, we're not going to execute. So they talk about that.
I know you're running out of time. I just want to ask you one other thing, and that is, I just want to comment on what I'm going to call the sort of gotcha aspect of this case, and that is the insurer did not take the position, if I understand it right, and maybe I'm wrong, that you could enter into this agreement, but we regard it as having no effect, and we intend to raise later the problem. Instead, they seem to give permission to enter into the agreement and then say, aha, now there's no damages.
Well, I will comment on that. There's two letters. There's one that MidCentury sent initially where they said, we give consent for Mr. James to enter into this because it provides full protection and we reserve the right to raise defenses and we're not waiving any rights. And then in response to that, counsel for Ms. Nunn rejected that and said, we want a simple letter that just says Farmers approves of Mr. James entering this agreement. And then we sent the simple letter that just says, I realize my time is up. May I, here, Chief? We responded to that with the simple letter. The letter says, we grant permission to Mr. James to enter into this agreement. So there was nothing in there where we, MidCentury, accepted the amount of it. There's nothing where we agreed that these terms are okay. It's just, we grant permission for him to do that. The reason for that is because we had to pay $100,000 under the agreement. So we had the, you know, we still had the policy limit. And what Mr. James was asking MidCentury to do was, I want to enter into this agreement, and you're going to have to pay that $100,000, and I want you to do this. So as part of the deal, it says Farmers were supposed to pay the $100,000. But to make sure that that actually happened, the parties wanted something in writing from Farmers that this is okay. So we granted permission for Mr. James to enter the agreement.
Thank you.
I don't want there to be any question here, but that it was the conduct of this insurance company that put Ms. Nunn into harm's way. We're not talking about an instance where, as I say, that the insurance company was defending the case and they had opportunities to settle. It was because of their failure to have put up the money. They didn't file that interpleader action for 14 months after the accident occurred. And so the fact is that we're talking about bad faith conduct by this insurance company that preceded any kind of obligation to defend. And therefore, the whole notion that somehow they were protecting their insured by entering into this agreement and paying these monies, it was only because of the fact that those were the only conditions under which Ms. Nunn was able, would be willing to resolve this matter with Mr. James, was by entering into one of these agreements, which has been allowed by this court. And so when we're talking about this whole notion of the Hamilton rule and the fact, the notion that somehow they were defending, it really has nothing to do with the facts in this case.
Mr. Levine, may I interrupt just one second? You've said that several times about allowed by this court, but is there any dispute that we have never held binding a prejudgment agreement like this?
Your Honor, I, with all due respect, quoting from the Ross case, this court said, under the rule we adopt today, the stipulated judgment would have been enforceable pursuant to a valid pretrial Basher agreement if the defendant insureds had proceeded successfully with any of their claims against Old Republic.
I appreciate and that. So, but we're all agreeing that what we said was, in an appropriate case, this is how we would decide it. But in this case, we're not upholding a prejudgment agreement like this.
We are, well, what we're asking the court to do is to sustain the agreement that was entered into this case.
And it was not.
Well, certainly the lower courts didn't allow it. That's true. They didn't allow it. But what this court said is that in an appropriate case, that where there is, it says that there may be circumstances where a stipulated judgment is a defendant insured's only viable recourse against an insurer that has acted in bad faith. And the court proceeded to quote from the Alaska decision out of the Great Divide case. And I would suggest to the court, I mean, we're going all the way back to 1942 when the Tenth Circuit said in the Traders in General case versus Rutko that why should the insured have to wait until the storm before seeking refuge? And the notion is that if you're subject to bad faith, that you should be able to enter into one of these agreements. And the last point I wanted to make is that the Court of Appeals, if the court were to accept what the Court of Appeals said in this case, it would overrule both the Basher case as well as the Ross case, because what the Court of Appeal said is that having fully protected himself or herself by virtue of obtaining the covenant not to execute on the excess judgment, the insured has eliminated his or her personal exposure and ipso facto suffered no such compensatory damages for the excess judgment. That applies either on a pretrial or on a post-trial basis, such as in the Basher case. So that's what Mid-Century is, in fact, asking this court to do if you sustain what the Court of Appeals did in this case. We would ask that the court reverse the decisions below and allow this case to proceed to a trial. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank all counsel for your arguments. Case will stand.